On this week in Enterprise Tech, we're revisiting the chip and PIN technology to see how effective on fraud it is. Linux may have a new malware for you to worry about. And Brian Curtis and I talk with Andy Warzon, CTO of Trek 10, who takes us through the benefits of serverless technology and functions as a service. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 318, recorded November 30th, 2018. Serverless and FAS from Trek 10. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by Avnet. Avnet and Not Impossible Labs created a historic event at the Life is Beautiful Music Festival, a first of its kind live concert that helped the deaf and hearing communities experience music in a whole new way. Visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. And by JW Player, helping businesses including twit.tv to make money on their video. To make more while saving 50% off your platinum subscription, visit jwplayer.com/twit and use code TWIT at checkout. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moraski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I needed some help from the experts in the enterprise community, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi, director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, and our geek in paradise. Chibert, you have a new little toy there, don't you?
Yes, I do. So, Callow, this is a scroll PV. I can actually unscroll it and charge the lithium ion battery inside. This was a Kickstarter kind of a long time ago. Combine this with a Sony digital paper, which is real nice and thin, and 8 ounces, by the way. And I have most of my reference collection on here, or will have just as I finish copying it all over. So I can now travel very easily with my entire reference collection.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, folks, we have not one but two experts in the field of enterprise, and we love having our favorite journalist on, Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how's it looking on your end down there in the swamp?
Well, down here in the swamp, it's been kind of a cold week. We had a couple of nights ago the coldest day in 311 days here. So last Tuesday, well, that was winter, and I'm glad I survived it, and looking forward to a nice long spring down here in the swamp.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, guys, for being here. On that note, we have a pretty jam-packed show today. We're going to talk a little about the effectiveness of chip and PIN and whether it has any movement on fraud at all, and whether also Linux may have a new malware to worry about. And our guest today talks us through the amazing benefits of serverless technology and functions as a service. But before we do all of that, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, isn't there there's a new commercial out there. I seem to have seen it once in a while about Chromebooks for the holidays, where the tagline is, if you're tired of malware, you Chromebook. Well, it seems those users aren't as safe as they think, as there's a new kid on the block in the world of malware, and this targets Linux users as well, and it may even creep its way out of the secure sandbox on Chromebook machines too. Now, see, you thought those machines were immune to such attacks. But I guess not. Now, the latest example of this trend is a new Trojan discovered this month by Russian antivirus maker Dr. Webb. This new malware strain doesn't have a fun name yet, but it's tracked under its generic detection name of Linux BTC Mine 174. Now, don't let that name fool you. This thing is complex all the way to the core. It's 1,000 lines of shell script. It starts out by finding a folder it has permission to write to and drops a Trojan there. Now, the Trojan downloads and runs a version of the Linux backdoor Gates 9 Trojan. And this family of backdoors allows commands issued by cybercriminals to be executed and DDoS attacks to be carried out. It then uses either the Dirty Cal exploit or others to get privileges and escalation and get the root full access to the machine. Now, after the Trojan has a firm grasp on your machine and your host, it then moves on to executing its primary function for which it was designed for, and that is cryptocurrency mining. Now, the Trojan first scans and determines and terminates processes of several other rival cryptocurrency mining malware families, and then it downloads and starts using its own Monero mining operation. I guess that's one way to get rid of the competition and get more nodes in the blockchain. Now, how is this disrupted? Well, how is this distributed, you may ask? Well, via SSH, self-spreading mechanism, of course. And however, it does rely on stealing valid SSH credentials, which actually means that even though it doesn't matter, it doesn't really matter the permission of the user who connects, this still affects the machine no matter what. Now, it might be time for you to survey your machines and make sure SSH is not leaving a gaping hole for your demise in the future.
Hey, what's half a billion records between friends? We're going to find out as more than 500 million guests of Starwood Hotels have had their personal information exposed in a mega hack breach that stretched from 2014 until this last September. That's according to a disclosure from Starwood parent Marriott International today. In their announcement, the hospitality giant provided some details but left many questions like who did it and what they wanted with all that data unanswered. Now, for approximately 327 million guests, the information includes some combination of name, mailing address, phone number, email address, passport number, Starwood preferred guest account information, date of birth, gender, arrival and departure information, reservation date, and communication preferences. For an undisclosed number of additional guests, you can add payment card number and expiration date to the list. Now, Marriott says that the credit card info was protected by AES 128 encryption, but they can't be sure that whoever got that data didn't also get the twin keys required for decryption. Now, Marriott says it has reported the breach to law enforcement agencies and is cooperating with their investigations, but legal fallout seems likely around the world. Class action lawsuits are almost certain in the U.S., and many in the international business community will be watching the EU as regulators begin their investigations into what may be the first large test of the penalties possible under GDPR. Email notifications have begun for affected customers, Marriott says, and in addition, the company has set up an informational website and is offering guests free enrollment in WebWatcher for a year.
All right, so our friends at AT&T saying the state net neutrality and privacy laws are a total disaster. AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson last week urged Congress to pass net neutrality and consumer data privacy laws that would prevent states from issuing their own stricter laws. Quote, there are a number of states that are now passing their own legislation around privacy and, by the way, net neutrality, Stephenson said in an interview at Wall Street Journal Tech Conference. What would be a total disaster for technology and innovation you see happening in Silicon Valley and elsewhere is to pick our head up and have 50 different sets of rules for companies trying to operate in the United States. Okay, great article. Strongly suggest you go and read it. However, while the article goes on and on, the point I want to make is that AT&T and several other large ISPs are missing the point. States would not be going through the pain of implementing such laws if the consumers weren't hammering their representatives to do something. So perhaps instead of bellyaching about having to potentially deal with 50 plus sets of net neutrality laws at each state and territory, perhaps they should be working on finding some middle ground. There's a Japanese word that I think does a very good job of putting this reaction into perspective. The word is called bocce, and in English, the best translation I can think of is, I told you so.
Now, If you were wondering what it takes to harden your router security, the German government might be able to help you out. Now, they're rolling out a program that will allow router vendors to tell you if their device is secure right out of the box. Now, the latest 22-page document published by the government lists tens of recommendations and rules for various router functions and features. The rules get funneled into a new certification program that allows router vendors to tag themselves with secure moniker in their marketing if they meet all the requirements. Now, there are some obvious items on the list, like making sure your Wi-Fi password should have a length of at least 20 digits or more and shouldn't contain any info derived from the router, like vendor, model, Mac, etc. Now, this is one was actually less obvious but interesting. The router should not be showing a password strength meter or force users to use special characters. Now, I think our banks and financial institutions out there might need a little bit of a lesson from this as well. Here's a couple other things that to get a small taste of what they put out there. The router must show the status and rules of any local firewall service, list all active services per interface, and provide a way to audit logins to the router interface. Not only that, but all routers should have an expiration date for the firmware. Now, I kind of like that one because it kind of forces the vendor to let you know that they will stop supporting you at some point. I've had appliances in the past that never get a firmware upgrade ever again, and because of the manufacturers actually deprecated it without telling anyone. That's real nice. Anyways, if they do that and they actually have an expiration after that, the vendor must let users use a custom or open source firmware to supplement the gap. Now, although this is just a program and not a law, in October, the state of California actually passed state legislation that established a strict set of rules for passwords used by internet-connected devices. This is making this the first IoT-specific regulation in the world. Now, to me, these types of programs are definitely a way to have vendors do the right thing for consumers and end users. Now, the holiday season's coming, and it's a field day for hackers targeting new devices with insecure default settings. Now, make sure you don't make the mistake this holiday season of not hardening your devices before you plug them in for service.
Well, the hackers behind the SamSam ransomware are now officially wanted by the feds. Two men, both Iranian nationals living in Iran, have been indicted in a criminal conspiracy around the creation and distribution of the SamSam ransomware campaign that hit more than 200 victims, mostly in the government, critical infrastructure, and healthcare sectors. Victims included the city of Atlanta, Port of San Diego, Colorado Department of Transportation, University of Calgary, and six healthcare-related entities. The indictment alleges that the two, named Savandi and Mansouri, have collected over $6 million in ransom payments to date and caused over $30 million in losses to victims. While the indictments mean that Savandi and Mansouri are now fugitives, it is believed that they are operating in Iran, which makes it unlikely that they'll be turned over to U.S. authorities unless they try to travel internationally. Well, SamSam may not be their only criminal enterprise as well, because according to a researcher, we have some evidence to suggest that they were investigating the possibility of stealing card payment data, and we have also seen the deployment of cryptocurrency miners in the environments of their victims.
Okay. Google, this is a little old story, but I need to talk about it. Google actually goes down, portion, after a BGP mishap routed traffic through China. Okay. Now, I'm not really going to talk about it actually being routed through China. It's happened. It's been talked about ad nauseum. But I do want to use this as a cautionary tale that, unfortunately, BGP is sadly a lot more fragile than most of us would like to think. The so-called BGP routing tables are, to a large extent, based upon trust, since the routing geek or technician slides in a set of numbers that represent where you think you are in relation to other levels of the internet. So to put this into perspective, in the past, I had to download some new drivers from AdTech, which is now Spirent, and that physical server realistically was only a mile away from my lab. After an hour of trying to download a 5 meg worth of drivers, I did a trace route and found that for some reason my Internet 2 connection was crossing over to the commodity world in Chicago instead of an exchange near Honolulu International Airport. So be careful, gang.
Her name was Lola. Well, not really. Actually, it's not as catchy, but they call it inferentia. And it's the new AWS-hosted dedicated machine learning chip. Now, this processor is a very high throughput, low latent, more cost-effective unit that is actually optimized for running machine learning operations. And Amazon has noticed that the speed and cost of running machine learning operations, especially for deep learning, are competitive differentiators for enterprises these days. But performance could literally make or break the success of enterprises today, and this custom hardware targets that to help that out. Now, Inferentia supports popular frameworks like Int8, FP16, and Mixed Precision. It also supports multiple machine learning frameworks, including TensorFlow, Caffe2, and Onyx. Now, since it's integrated in the AWS ecosystem, it also supports data from AWS products such as EC2, SageMaker, and the new Elastic Inference Engine announced this past week. Now, if you're excited about adding some ML to your data pipeline and wanted to squeeze as much performance out of processing as you can, you're going to have to wait till next year when the service is deployed to mainstream users. Now, if you can't wait until then, other services like Azure FPGA offer hardware-optimized scenarios for machine learning and AI. Now, FPGAs make it possible to achieve low latency for real-time inferencing requests and can batch and collect large amounts of data, feeding it to the processor to improve hardware utilization. Now, if you want to get started this year with a bit of business insights, it might be time to start making your data work for you. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. Before we do, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, home buying is definitely not easy. It's really stressful. In fact, I remember buying my last house, and it wasn't fun. I had to deal with multiple banks, constant communication with different bank reps, and I had to search around my house through my filing cabinets for all that information, and I had to worry about interest rate hikes. Now, it's nerve-wracking and it takes forever. Now, the market today is really unpredictable, so it causes a lot of anxiety. Now, while our friends at Quicken Loans noticed all the pitfalls in the process, and they're trying to do something about it, they're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. You answer a few simple questions, and they actually pre-qualify you in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, this gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Now, in the current market, that is a huge advantage as a buyer because sometimes you actually have to put an offer in at the moment's notice right at an open house. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new Rate Shield approval. Now, they actually lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part of it. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. Now, you're probably thinking, if the rate goes down, they won't tell me about it. That's not true. If the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, if you ask me as a buyer, you seem to have the upper hand here because either way, you're going to win and you're going to stay up to date what's going on. Now, this is just the kind of thinking and the programs you expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, if you're thinking about buying a house right now, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, you remember chip and PIN and all the hassle retailers and you had to go through to transition to it. Well, we were promised that because of all this disruption and the pain in the neck, we were also going to get some advantages from it. And that was to reduce fraud and better our security of our credit and our identity. Well, a security firm, Gemini Adversary, recently posted a report saying that credit card fraud is actually on the rise in the U.S. this year. Now, even though chip cards create a unique code for each transaction and sometimes require customers to enter a PIN to prove their identity, it was found that this doesn't make stealing info from the chip-based cards impossible. Now, Gemini Adversary now says that 60 million credit and debit card numbers were stolen in the U.S. in the past 12 months, and most of those were chip-based cards. Now, how do they find this information? Well, they trolled the dark web sites where stolen credit cards were sold. Now, 45.5 million or 75% of the numbers posted were from POS systems, point of sale systems, in a brick and mortar stores, and only 25% of them were actually from online retailers. Now, why are EMV cards being stolen when we were promised that that wouldn't happen? Well, Gemini reports that they feel it's because of retailer compliance. Now, most merchants really haven't chosen to upgrade and are still using the old magnetic strip process. And also, they're not forcing a PIN is also another use where retailers don't really even require you to sign anymore. Now, what's going on here? Well, it's reported that the firm, from the merchant's perspective, the cost of fraud might be less of the cost of figuring out what needs to be done after they buy a chip and card reader. All right, guys. I want to bring you guys in because I think this is kind of almost a case of a bait and switch here, because I think we were made to believe that there's this convenience thing coming along, this new tech to save our butts. And what happened? What do you think, Chubert?
I've been saying it and saying it until I'm blue in the face. We really need to go chip and PIN, not chip and sign. And I'm just a little bit afraid. I don't know if you've noticed, but some retailers like Costco, the floor limit that doesn't require a signature is almost $400. You know, that's a lot of potential fraud. So my personal opinion is, yeah, I'm sorry. We really need to go chip and PIN, and we really need to go and say, hey, if you're still using swipe, your credit card device is no longer going to work. We've got to do this. There's got to be something to force people to use something more secure, because I don't know about you, I'm getting really sick and tired of having to change credit cards what sounds like almost once a year because of all this fraud. And with this Marriott thing, I know I'm going to have to change a whole bunch of my American Express cards that I use for travel. This is a drag, and it needs to stop right now.
Yeah, I think the really odd part here is it's almost making it less secure, because a lot of retailers, they don't require that PIN, and then they'll just say, oh, you don't even need to sign. So you just put the card in there and you run away, and that's really it, especially on those self-checkout lines. You just go up there, put the card in, then walk away. Even when I go to lunch at some of the restaurants around here, you stick that card in there and just walk away. So I think it's almost like false security in some ways. I know that the whole idea here is you are getting a unique ID, and you know that you actually have to physically have that card with the chip in it. But that doesn't prevent somebody from stealing it and still doing it. What do you think, Kurt? Were we bait switched here? Like, do we feel like we have a false sense of security?
Well, do we feel like we have a false sense of security? Only slightly. I mean, let's be really honest. The percentage of fraud is still pretty large. As to why we didn't go to chip and PIN, well, the answer is simple. It's because Americans are stupid. That's according to the card associations and the merchants. We just couldn't put another PIN into our tired, poor, overworked little brains. And as to why the merchants are willing to go without the signature, here's the next dirty little secret. The reason that they are able to do that is because they don't bear responsibility for the transaction. When it comes to a card-present transaction, and that's critical because there are card-present and card-not-present, or CNP, charges. With a card-present charge, once they get authorization back from a credit card clearinghouse, the merchant has no liability for something that goes wrong. The liability in a card-present transaction lies with the issuing association, which means that the association, Visa or MasterCard, is responsible, not the individual banks, not the individual merchant, not the customer. It's that association. And that distancing from liability is part of what makes the merchant feel comfortable lowering the transactional friction and allowing someone just to insert their chip-based card and go. Things are a little bit different with American Express and Discover. Those are single entities, but the principle is the same. When it comes to a card-present charge, the merchant isn't on the hook for them once they have approval. What's it going to take to improve things? Well, there are groups working on this. I went to a conference here in Orlando earlier this year. But a lot of it boils down, frankly, to things like behavioral biometrics. In other words, is the charge that you're making something that is within your pattern of charging, or is it way outside your normal pattern, either because of where it's happening or because of what's going on? If it is, then they're liable to require more interrogation of the customer, meaning more steps, before they approve the charge. Things like when they do require a signature, watching how the signature happens. This is behind the scenes. It doesn't really raise the friction, but it is a form of biometrics that's being increasingly used by retail and the rest of industry as it does its best to put a limit on just how much fraud is taking place.
Right. I think, you know, it's interesting because we didn't take on, you talked about how the retailers don't put the extra friction in there and they don't require the whole PIN idea. I mean, it sounds like, you know, even in the, the security and the identity provider sense, when people are logging in today, they've increased their security by offering kind of this additional 2MFA, you know, the multi-factor authentication, where now you have to provide some other proof of identity, whether it's a PIN or if it's a, you know, authenticator that you have on your phone, some other entity that you have to have in your possession to be able to do that. Cheebert, what do you think? Is this something that maybe some of these card manufacturers and holders, these financial institutions, should start doing? Should they start adding maybe some additional security on top of it that's just required? Obviously, you can't require that the PIN system is there because that requires that you've remembered your PIN. But if you maybe say, hey, like, you need to have something on your phone, or this particular card requires that you have an authenticator or something like that, would also then kind of force these retailers to move into this process, into that workflow?
I don't know. You know, I personally think a PIN's not that bad. You know, I've used a PIN on several of my cards. You know, I've had a European card at one time, and I had to use chip and PIN, and wasn't that bad. But yeah, being able to have, you know, the retailers want as little friction as possible because they don't want someone to say, okay, forget it, I'm not going to buy it. You know, that's one thing that the retailers really don't want. And that's one of the big reasons why floor limits exist. You know, a lot of retailers don't want to have to force the consumer to even sign if they're just going to, say, a food truck and buying lunch. And, you know, okay, fine. You know, I can agree with that. But when the floor limits start getting up into the several hundred dollars, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't make enough money that a $400 fraud doesn't hurt. I mean, you know, a couple hundred dollars really hurts because I don't make a ton of money. I would really like my banks to protect my hard-earned money a little better than they are. And yeah, I understand. So I'm not getting liable for it. But I am paying for it because the credit card vendors are going to take that fraud and they're going to roll it into higher fees. They're going to pass it on to consumers. So I'm paying for it anyway. And that's what I really object to. I want the system to be more secure. I realize chip and PIN isn't the do-all, end-all. But from what I can see of numbers, it is better than chip and sign. And I would love to see America go to that.
Right. So I want to throw this back to Kurt. I want to get this is the time of year where people are buying a ton of stuff online. You know, obviously this security firm said, hey, only 25% of what we saw was from online retailers. But it's almost like the card holder manufacturers should basically train users, because they have their own machines, mobile devices that they're using to buy this stuff. Train users in a way of using a specific process that would get them used to it, so that when they went to the brick and mortar, they would be able to use something else. So, Kurt, why aren't we seeing online services force more security around it, other than just putting your card and your security ID on the back of the card in there?
The simple reason for that is that, well, security costs money. Now, I remember back, oh, heavens, 15, 20 years ago, when online commerce was just getting started, there were things like card readers that plugged into a USB port or into a serial port. At that point, you get them with 9-pin serial adapters. And with the idea being that when you went to a website, and bought something, you would take your card and physically scan it right there with encrypted information being sent back to the merchant. Well, not surprisingly, that idea didn't go anywhere. And the fact is that we're not going to get a major step in physical card present transactional safety until the swipers go away. And believe me, I don't see a good reason for them not to. I mean, Carol and I, for some of our things, we have a Square account. We went in and got the chip reader. It also allows us to take things like Apple Pay and Google Pay. Doesn't cost much money, makes it more secure. And the good folks at Square will actually give you a break on the percentage if you use it. For things online, there's really not a lot to do about making it more secure from the consumer side, unless you do one thing, and that is use a VPN if you're not connecting from your house. If you're sitting at Starbucks and decide that you just have to have the latest left-handed smoke shifter, well, feel free to buy it if you are connected via VPN. And yeah, I know that the websites are all SSH. They're all use a VPN. You can get free VPNs. You can get low-cost VPNs. Regardless of which sort you use, use a VPN. From the merchant side, there are a lot of things that they're doing behind the scenes. Like I said, they're looking at behavioral authentication. There are some things that they're doing to make it less attractive for people to take shortcuts. So again, it gets back to this notion I talk about a lot, transactional friction. What the merchants and the banks are trying to do is lower that friction for legitimate customers while throwing just as much sand as possible into the works for the criminals.
Right. Well, I'll tell you one thing, that these pay services, like Apple Pay, I actually had forgotten my credit card on Black Friday, which is the worst day to do that. And I was in a couple of retailers and I was like, well, how am I going to pay? And of course, because I forgot my wallet as well, my ID wasn't there. And so I actually could just, I just pulled my phone out, tapped it, boom, and away I went. So I think, you know, that this, maybe we were, you know, these companies are right, as maybe it's just getting away from these credit card companies entirely and in physical cards to help with this. Then we can start enforcing more security and things. We'll have to wait and see. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Avnet. Now, Avnet brings a new meaning to groundbreaking technology. They want to make technology more accessible to everyone. Now, Not Impossible Labs had an idea. They wanted to revolutionize live music. Now, live music for people who can hear can sometimes be taken for granted. Now, it's an experience like no other because live music can affect all of our senses. Now, this is where Avnet took on a challenge to make an experience like this more accessible to everyone, including the deaf community. Now, how do they do that? With the Avnet as their guide, Not Impossible Labs helped bring shared live concert experiences to everyone. Now, dubbing it Music Not Impossible, the product allows the deaf and hearing concertgoers alike to literally feel live music through advanced vibration technology. Now, the wearable technology helps the user immerse themselves and experience music like no other. You wear a vest, which sends vibrations through the ankles, the wrist, and the chest. Now, people who can hear receive music vibrations through their ears, while attendees who are deaf and wearing these wearables receive these vibrations throughout other parts of their body, allowing many of them to actually respond to live music alongside everyone else. Now, for many people, this is an experience of a lifetime. It's an innovation that literally opens up a whole new world of music exploration to those who might not hear in the more traditional sense. Now, Avnet and Not Impossible Labs revealed this amazing technology at the Life is Beautiful Music Festival, and it was an instant success. Now, this is just the kind of innovation that we expect coming from a place like Avnet, and I love really hearing about innovation coming from companies and really cool stuff like this. So this is really a cool sponsor. Now go ahead and visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. That is avnet.com/music1. And we thank Avnet for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, this is my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today is no exception. We have Andy Warzon, CTO of Trek 10 Incorporated. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of cloud services, especially serverless technology. But before we get into all that goodness, our folks at home love to hear origin stories. So can you kind of take us through maybe a quick journey of your career in tech?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in tech for almost 20 years now. Started back in sort of the early days of the internet in the 90s. And really the past 10 years or so, I've been a really heavy user of Amazon Web Services. My experience is pretty broad across software development, infrastructure, data and analytics as well. But been a really heavy user of Amazon Web Services for almost as long as it's been a viable option. And really where Trek 10 came from was my focus on that and seeing more and more with enterprises out there and companies out there that there's a huge need for help in using Amazon Web Services. It's such a deep feature set and such a broad offering. And this goes for more and more all the other cloud offerings as well, that the companies really need a lot of help getting up and running. And so that's really where Trek 10 came from, which we launched about 5 years ago and have been growing really heavily ever since.
Fantastic. So the interesting thing is we heard about IaaS, infrastructure as a service. We've heard about PaaS, where you got basically you can actually have different actually products as a service as well. But now this is this new thing, this FaaS. What the heck is FaaS?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, good question. So functions as a service. So really, in a lot of ways, FaaS is another iteration of PaaS, right? So the idea of platform as a service, as opposed to infrastructure as a service. So cloud infrastructure as a service, you're dealing with the basic infrastructure primitives that you're used to in the data center. They're just delivered to you as a service, right? You're dealing with network, you're dealing with virtual machines, operating systems, and the like. The platform of service as a service, that's abstracted away from you, right? So you don't have to deal with the operating system, the virtual machine at all, and you can focus on your application. But like you said, platforms have been around for a while. So what's different about FaaS is really the unit of abstraction is probably the place to start. So the unit, of course, is the function. So the idea is that you upload just your individual function code into the cloud provider, and then that function code is run in an isolated manner every time it's invoked. And the real power here is that you get really essentially unlimited concurrency out of the box and no resource contention from the beginning, right? So you when your function runs, it has its own isolated set of resources. You can have that function run concurrently thousands of times a second immediately after you upload it, and you never have to think one bit about any of the scaling behind that. So that's the first thing. The other thing that makes functions as a service and really the broader idea of serverless different than previous platform offerings is this idea of really never having to touch the capacity settings or never having to pay for idle. So previous platform offerings, it's been pretty common where you have a lever, right? Some sort of a dial that you have to turn up and down when you need more capacity. With serverless, with functions as a service, there really is no need to provision that capacity at all. And then even more compellingly, you'd never have to pay for idle. So with Amazon Web Services with Lambda, they round up to the 100 milliseconds. So at most, you're going to pay for 99 extra milliseconds of compute time. So essentially, you're never paying when you're not serving requests. And that's really compelling because with cloud offerings, you know, there's this ability to scale, of course, that everyone's used to hearing about now. But the reality is that usually companies still have their cloud servers heavily underutilized, right? 5% utilization is a common metric that's thrown around. And so that other 95% is still cost waste. And so with functions as a service, you no longer pay for that.
So, Neil, these services, Amazon, Azure, if basically offered a way to deploy PaaS services more efficiently, let's say they provide some template that you can just kind of go out there and do that, you're saying that they wouldn't even be more efficient and more cost effective than functions, because functions, you just don't, you pay for basically, it's pay for play. You pay for what you use And, you know, if it's idle, you don't pay for anything. So if they sit there and do nothing, you don't pay for anything. Plus, you're saying the advantages are also the scalability of these things because they can just auto scale. But what if these applications, these PaaS services can auto scale as well? So really, it's really the pay for play that's the helpful thing, or is there other kind of facets of this thing that I'm missing?
Yeah, that's right. Pay for play is a big part of it. The other big thing is really that unit of abstraction drives a lot of best practices around architecture, right? So with traditional platform offerings, when you have, you essentially can still use the single monolithic application abstraction. With FAS and serverless, what you're really doing is you're breaking apart your application into much smaller piece parts, right? So you have individual functions you're uploading to the functions as a service provider, and then you're taking other single use services for other individual use cases, like for example the identity service or a full text search service or a cloud database service, and you're stitching all those services together. And so really taking the best of breed from all those and connecting those with events. So this is the idea of event-driven architectures. And this forces you, one, to have a much more decoupled architecture, but two, it really lets you take the best of breed from all these different services and in all these cases focus a lot more on your business logic and not on the underlying infrastructure associated with each of those single-use services.
Right. Now, I know you said you're very familiar with the AWS offerings. Now we know that there's other offerings out there. Like, obviously, we've heard of AWS Lambda services. There's Azure Functions, Google Functions, and of course, now IBM Cloud Functions. Now, what are there any really differences to these services? Are they all kind of on the same premise that they offer, you know, pay for play, quick deployment, better security because they handle all that for you in the background? Is there anything that these services kind of offer that are more so than the other?
Yeah, I think the big difference between all the different cloud offerings is not actually in the function as a service piece itself. That is getting much more commoditized every month. All the cloud providers are providing closer and closer to parity offerings there. And that's really at the end of the day, though, the glue. What's a lot more differentiated with the different clouds are the other services that you want to piece together, right? So a classic serverless architecture is going to have 3, 4, 5, 6 different services from the cloud provider that it's pulling together. So an example of a more unique service might be something like the GraphQL service that AWS offers called AppSync, right? So for whatever your use case is, there are services that you're going to need to pull together, and that's really where I think you want to focus your comparison with the different cloud offerings is in those differentiated services.
Yeah, so that leads me to the next question there, and it's around kind of the portability of these things. So like you go and develop a little bit of code to generate or create a function. Are you vendor locked in? Are you locked into that vendor now, into that serverless technology, or is this become portable and I can go and say, you know what, I want something more on Google Cloud now, and so I want to move over there, and so I want to take my functions with me. Can I do that, or is there a little bit more effort to do that?
Yeah, there's absolutely more effort to do that. So you have a bigger portability concern with this than with other approaches. That's just a reality that I think companies have to grapple with. The cost benefit trade-off there, it's additional switching costs that you didn't have in the past because you're actually integrating your code with the cloud service provider. But there are huge benefits associated with it as well. And we think in a lot of cases, those additional switching costs are well worth the benefits. But that said, there are a few things that people that are worried about that could keep in mind. One is there's an ecosystem out there of orchestration and deployment frameworks for serverless, the serverless framework being the most popular, oldest one of those, and those that have multi-cloud capabilities. So serverless framework works with AWS, Google, and Azure, and so you can you can use that framework to move your functions if you're concerned about that or if you need to address that. But again, I think really the bigger lock-in concern is actually not the functions part of it. Those are relatively easier at least to move. And the bigger focus for portability discussion, I think, with anyone looking at using it serverless is the other services that you're using, right? So unique database offerings from all these cloud providers, as everyone knows that, you know, the database is often one of the most challenging parts of your application to make changes to. And so unique pieces, unique functionality in different database offerings can provide, can end up being a much bigger lock-in focus than the actual function.
Totally makes sense. So we've talked a little bit about the technology. We've talked a little bit about the services, the different variances out there. What about types of applications? So obviously, we can't necessarily build all types of applications on functions or serverless technology. What kind of things can I be built out there? What kind of organizations and what organizations can build on top of it?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, so more and more now, and especially with the reInvent launches that happened this week, it's actually usually more of a question of what can't you build on it. There's a huge variety of things that you can build. It's not just web applications or APIs. A huge number of offerings in terms of things like big data processing, IoT, and many, many others. So that probably more interesting is focusing on the things that you can't do. One of the biggest that you know we usually take away from serverless is long running compute jobs, right? So AWS Lambda used to have a 5-minute timeout, and now it has a 15-minute timeout. So, but still, there are many compute processes that take a lot longer than 15 minutes. So mm-hmm. long-running compute is definitely a reason to not use serverless. Another one is a very, very fast single millisecond response times. So this is an important area to talk about, because there's, I think, a lot of concern out there about serverless and the response times. And the reality is there is a response time limit that if you need to meet, you shouldn't be using serverless. And like I said, it's in that single digit sort of mm-hmm. area, uncached. But you know, the reality is most people, when they say they need a fast, they don't mean single-digit milliseconds, right? They mean tens or hundreds of milliseconds, and you can absolutely use serverless to get those response times.
Got it. So what another thing that's interesting is, what about the scenario? So you said there's some scenarios where you don't want to use it. Now, there are scenarios where you need to maybe have kind of a workflow or a kind of event-driven thing where one thing happens and another thing happens. And now I'm more familiar with Azure. They have something called Logic Apps where you can basically kind of chain serverless technologies and kind of microservices together. Is there something kind of similar that maybe AWS supports that offers a little bit more versatility and still be able to use serverless?
Yeah, so Logic Apps is a really cool offering, and it really highlights the unique parts of what Azure offers versus other clouds in terms of the integration to so many different business applications. In the AWS ecosystem, the orchestration service for workflows is something called Step Functions. So this is really a state machine orchestrator. It's a really powerful service. It doesn't have as many built-in integrations. They actually just this week at reInvent released a set of built-in integrations, but they're still integrations to pretty low-level primitives within AWS. So it's not these aren't integrations into business applications like you get with Logic Apps. But Step Functions is probably the closest relative to Logic Apps in AWS.
Fantastic. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Azure Functions. I'm sorry, Azure Functions, serverless technology, functions as a service, AWS, Lambda, so on and so forth. And we get to bring my co-host back in to talk a little bit about that stuff. But before we do, I want to thank another sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that is JW Player. Now, everyone watches videos online, and when it works really well, you don't even notice what the player is that's playing the video. Now, if you look a little closer, you'll notice that it's most likely JW Player. Now, having built tons of front ends, I can tell you that JW Player is one of the most flexible and feature-rich HTML5 video platforms out there today. It's easy to integrate, and it helps you meet your site's designs, brand, and it has some awesome features. Now, if it's time for you to grow up from YouTube, JW Player has you covered. Now, the spectrum goes from the casual YouTuber all the way up to large-scale publishers and broadcasters who want to maximize video ad fill rates and CPMs. Now, if you've visited the Twit website, you probably noticed that when you watch an episode on the site, it uses JW Player. Now, as Leo says, it is one of the most important features of the Twit website. The quick access to any show right on the site is critical for Twit's business, and JW Player gets out of the way and lets Twit shine. Now, Twit is not the only one using this awesome player. Top websites and publishers like Washington Post, Business Insider, and Vice all are able to customize the JW Player for their needs. Plus, JW Player was able to be integrated into their brands and seamlessly integrated into their website design. Now, if you already want to take control of your video experience, here is what JW Player can bring to the table. Now, they offer buffer-free technology, which makes it one of the fastest players on the net, a fully customizable player to match your brand, video CMS to manage your uploads and videos. Plus, if you're running ads, this player will help you max out your fill rates and CPM. Now, to me, If you're serious about offering content, JW Player is the way to go. Now, for a limited time, download the free ebook, The Modern Publisher's Guide to Video Advertising. Visit jwplayer.com/twit and use code TWIT at checkout, and you'll get 50% off your Platinum subscription. Now, this is a limited time exclusive offer for twit.tv listeners. Be sure to check it out today. That's jwplayer.com/twit and use code TWIT at checkout. And we thank JW Player for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Andy, I want to go ahead and bring my co-host back in, but I have a ton of other questions. Hopefully, we'll have some time for those as well. But I think Curtis had some questions about security.
Yeah, I do have some questions about security, and it really gets down to beginning with a question of just how many components are involved in a web-based application or a cloud-based application with this function architecture. You know, when you talk about zero trust, there's the notion of putting in authentication between every component. Are we at a point where that's going to add an awful lot of overhead, or do you have other solutions for making sure that you've draped a security umbrella over the entire application if you're using this architecture?
That's right. That's a great question, Kurt. You're absolutely right, because you have these individual components, and they can be in an individual application, tens of components, maybe in some cases hundreds, but usually tens is a common number. And so you absolutely do have more endpoints to take care of, right? More places where you have to watch for bad input and output, and more cases where you have to make sure the trust layer is well defined. So that does add overhead. Certainly, you know, you're trading that off for other overhead that you now get rid of, like dealing with the operating system, right? So it's shifting some operational security responsibility. There is an ecosystem of tools that's developing that, like you said, offers an ability to sort of drape security on top of that. There's some security startups in the serverless space, Protego, Twistlock, PureSec are a few examples I can think of off the top of my head that are providing products along these lines. And so really what they're doing is they're putting basically a security firewall in the function as a service to analyze input and output. And they're also analyzing those trust definitions, those IAM definitions around each of the individual components to make sure they're as tight as possible. So then, you know, they're also looking at an area that's not unique to serverless, but it becomes, I think, more of a focus, which is the dependency vulnerabilities. So that's definitely a growing area, and I think will be pretty critical for enterprises looking to leverage serverless.
Well, let me ask just one more question, and this is based a little bit off of that thing you mentioned with the dependencies. Do you worry about data normalization and data checking from function to function and step to step? Because, you know, not only is that a security issue, making sure that the data that you're passing is of a type that makes sense to the next function, but it has to do with just basic application functionality. And it strikes me that could become more complex if you're building something on many, many layers of these independent functions.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. It's really the same principles that, you know, have been applied to web applications for a long time about input cleansing, validation, and web application vulnerability that really apply now to every component that is receiving events, from another component. And so you absolutely need to be concerned about that validity of each of those components. And like I said, there's additional overhead of that hopefully some of these security vendors can help simplify.
Okay, Andy, my turn. I got a question. We've got a lot of really cool things happening. I love the talk about the performance and all that, but manageability is one of the things that I've got to be concerned with, especially when you start running, say, a 24/7 operation, you know, around the globe, and all of a sudden I've got lesser trained third shift personnel. Are there management tools out there to be able to manage these functions so that I don't have to have, you know, a $100,000 a year engineer always on shift?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, I think there's definitely a skills gap with a lot with operating serverless. So we do 24/7 support for serverless environments. So we're well aware of this and dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. There's definitely a skills gap with the typical operators, but one that can be closed, I think, relatively easily. You know, the reality is you have a lot less knobs and dials to deal with here. And in a lot of cases, you know, if there's a major outage, right, that's on the cloud provider. And for better or worse, there's not a lot you can do with a major outage usually. And when there are problems that you can deal with, there are a lot fewer dials to deal with those problems. We use a monitoring platform that aggregates all of our data and all of our events to give a single pane of glass to an operator who is maybe less of a senior engineer to you know dig in a much more structured way. So that's a valuable step forward. It's really important too to be applying automation best practices here as well. So there's a lot less that can go wrong, and when something does go wrong, you know, with your infrastructure, it's all completely traceable and auditable with infrastructure as code and automated deployment.
Okay, well, how about what happens when we have people that need something to plug into their legacy? So, like for instance, my shop runs EM7 by ScienceLogic, which is an SMP-based system, and then TotalView. Can we plug in some of the monitoring into legacy monitoring systems, or do we need another pane running some monitoring tools in the NOC?
Yeah, I know ScienceLogic in particular offers a pretty good AWS integration, so I imagine you have options. These days, almost every major vendor out there is supporting metrics from all the major cloud providers. So hopefully you shouldn't have to do that. That would be pretty unfortunate if you had to add in another pane of glass. And typically that's not a challenge. What may be more unique are some of the custom metrics associated with serverless, but we're seeing support increase very fast with the different monitoring tool providers. So if yours isn't there now, it should be soon.
So kind of on top of that question, it kind of leads me to the question around deployment. So a lot of times these organizations, they're trying to move a lot of their applications to the cloud or some particular function, like for instance, maybe image transfer or image conversion or something like that. And they want to move it from on-prem to online. Does this kind of like ecosystem also support like hybrid type mechanisms where you have on-premise and online at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question. You know, that's actually an area that has been developing a lot recently and has become a lot more possible very recently. In fact, this week at reInvent, AWS made an announcement that's big in this area in the AWS world, which is there's something called an application load balancer, which has been typically used as a front end for virtual machines. And now the application load balancer supports Lambda functions as well. So that provides a way to have a bit of a hybrid capability. You know, other than that, you know, there's DNS load balancing is valuable. You know, we like to take the approach of peeling back the onion when it comes to migrating something from on-premise. So maybe you're not going to be doing an active load balancing between your on-premise and your serverless environment, but you can peel off from the onion model, peel off a piece at a time from the existing application and move it slowly but surely into serverless and into cloud.
Right. So now we've talked a little bit about the technology, about the kind of the ecosystem. Can you maybe give us a little snippet of like what Trek 10 does and what kind of applications and systems they've kind of built on top of this?
Yeah, so we design, build, and support cutting edge architectures with 100% focus on Amazon Web Services, has been since the day we started, with 100% focus on AWS. And specifically within that, we have a heavy focus on DevOps, IoT, and serverless. So we're helping companies all across the lifecycle from initial upfront guidance, training, and enablement to design and building and deploying applications. And then on the back end, providing 24/7 support when they're up and running. So provide that whole lifecycle of services, but with a really heavy focus on AWS and serverless.
Got it. So you talked a lot about DevOps, and a lot of people out there are saying, okay, like I really want to get into this DevOps, this whole CI/CD loop mechanism. What type of features do these services offer that kind of reduce the impedance from when you're developing something to you want to roll it out and you want to kind of get rolled out quickly? Is there some additional features that some of these PaaS services don't offer, or is it similar?
It's very, very similar. You know, we work a lot with the different platform or with the different CI/CD services and have found a way to make almost every one of those work with, in fact, every one of those work with serverless. And typically, it's not even that huge of a change. So whether you're using Jenkins or some cloud service offering like CircleCI, building automation and DevOps around serverless is not a big change. And something we've actually been working on a lot is making that even easier for companies. So we recently worked with AWS to help them build a plugin for Jenkins for SAM, the serverless application model for AWS. So that makes it even easier if you're a Jenkins user to get up and running with DevOps. We're working on something like GitLab as well. And so hopefully this will become even more plug and play in the future.
Now, what about a little bit about DevOps? Is a lot of companies, they want to kind of flight or roll out some of their capabilities. Does these functions and or FAS kind of offer that ability to have different kind of environments and be able to different roll out to like beta, be able to roll out to production, be able to roll out to different flights within production, or is it kind of all or nothing?
Absolutely. No, it's not all or nothing. There's capability within AWS. I can't speak to the other clouds as expertly, but within AWS, there's an ability to do blue-green deployments, where you're just switching out one environment for the other, but keeping the other environment live for a quick cutback if you need to. And there's also an ability to do canary deployments. So really not a small fraction of the traffic in a controlled manner. Both of those are very possible and very well supported within the AWS serverless ecosystem, at least.
So there's some questions about that we've seen in the chat room, maybe about like different application types that are not good. Now, one of them that kind of came to mind was like, for instance, if I wanted to build a chat service or something that required a WebSocket connection, is these something that a FAS service would be good for, bad for, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Until a few days ago, I would have said, oh, that's a little bit of a rough one. But actually, AWS made a big announcement just yesterday, actually. Which is that the API Gateway service, which is AWS's API endpoint, actually would use in front of Lambda functions to expose an internet-facing API. That service now supports WebSockets. So that's a really huge improvement for the ecosystem and opens up a whole new class of applications that you can build. So you can now have a stateful WebSockets connection, have a Lambda function as a service, servicing requests on that stateful connection. It's really compelling new opportunity.
That's awesome. Well, folks, we've run out of time. I want to give Andy just one more, another minute or so to give us a little insights into where they can go to find out about Trek 10. Where can an organization go to get started? Where can they get in contact with you? That kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. So our Twitter handle is on the screen there at Trek 10 Inc. We're active very heavily on there. Trek10.com is our website. And we have a great blog at trek10.com/blog. We blog about a lot of things, both from high level to really technical topics. We have a great topic on there. If you're interested in getting into serverless from a business perspective, or you're interested in trying to convince your organization to adopt more serverless, we have a great article about business case for serverless that you might want to take a look at or send around to your decision makers. We also have a podcast, as you see on there, that we've been doing for a while called Think FAS. 5-minute podcast, so it's a fun, quick one to listen to get a little bit of an introduction to serverless computing.
Fantastic. That was Andy Wars on CTO of Trek 10. Andy, thank you so much for being here. We really enjoyed our discussion.
All right. Thanks, Lou.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast, according to 9 out of 10 serverless functions. I want to thank anyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime with whom I wouldn't want to do this show, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, you can find my writing over at Dark Reading. That's darkreading.com. And I pretty much always point to my new pieces at my Twitter handle. That's at KG4GWA. Speaking of the Twitter handle, got a question. Are there any books that you think are critical for security professionals to read? Something that made a difference in your career? If so, hit me up on Twitter and let me know. I would love to put together a reading list for some folks.
Fantastic. Thanks, Kurt. Also, we have to thank our geek in paradise and our very own producer, Mr. Brian Chiebert. Where can people find you and all of your fun work?
I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. I'm also Chiebert at twit.tv, or better yet, use Twiet at twit.tv and email us all. Drop us some lines on what you'd like to see in here. Also, new toy. Want to teach it to identify fishies in the webcams. Ought to be a fun project.
Fantastic. Well, Curtis, Brian, thank you again for being here. You guys make this show great. We also want to thank you. You are that person that drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and support us to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you each and every week to listen and to catch up on your enterprise goodness and your enterprise news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twite. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, co-host information, and our guest information, plus the links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download or subscribe links that help you actually help support our show by getting either the audio version, video version, HD video version, and you can listen on any one of your devices. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise IT news. Now, after you subscribe, go ahead and share the show with your friends and family and coworkers. Also, don't forget that we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is made. And if you're going to go in and join live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well, irc.twit.tv. We always have a really great discussion there, some great questions, some great characters in there. So feel free to drop in and be part of the Twiat Riot. Now, also, you can don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You can see all my things that I post there about tech and about how I'm just getting annoyed with Black Friday retailers. But also, you get to see what I do on my daily work at Microsoft, where you can actually check that out as well at dev.office.com, where we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience and make it more productive. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. And I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit. Also, thank you to Mr. Brian Chi for our producer. He's the one that kind of does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we wouldn't want to do this show without him. And before we sign out, I have to thank our TD today, Kevin. Now, Kevin, along with the normal tradition, can you tell the folks at home what the topic of the show was today?
Something about DIY restaurants because they're serverless.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, that you were real close, because I think that DIY restaurants could definitely be on serverless, but unfortunately it was a function as a service. So maybe next time, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining us. Until that next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you just want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.